will bring this meeting to order. This is the Energy Utilities Technology and Communications Committee. And I'm not sure we'll have a quorum today. I imagine people will be filtering in and out. It happens to be a deadline week. So there are a lot of bills being heard. This is an informational session, and we've been talking a lot about smart grid technology throughout this session, and so we thought we would have a more formal presentation. And here with us today is Michael Lamb, who's the Director of IT Strategy and Customer Operations at Xcel Energy. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Michael Lamb, and I work for Xcel Energy, and in a nutshell, my job today is to run IT. I've been at Xcel previous to that NSP since I graduated from the University of Minnesota in various capacities, primarily on the transmission and distribution side of the house. And I'm a born and raised in St. Louis Park, so I'm a longtime Minnesota resident. And I'm here to talk to you a little bit about Xcel Energy's smart grid effort. My objective is pretty simple, just to provide you information with what smart grid means to Xcel Energy and how we are trying to realize it through our smart grid city effort in Boulder, Colorado. So when I first got the assignment about 3.5 years ago or so to make smart grid a reality for Xcel Energy, one of the first roadblocks we faced was to define what it was. So many people, it lacks a definition. It's a widely used term without a very clear definition. So I thought I'd spend just a minute on what it's not and what it is for Xcel Energy. So on the screen right now is some of the things that it's not. AMI typically stands for, it stands for a couple of different things, but the most common one is automated meter infrastructure. Smart meters is a common term often used. A meter that sits on the side of a house that a utility and a consumer perhaps even can talk with in real-time, two-way, robust communications. While a fundamental piece of smart grid for Xcel Energy, that's not what smart grid is. It's a piece of it. Distribution automation. Switches on our distribution system that automatically operate depending on the circumstances, restoring power automatically, isolating faults, et cetera. Again, a piece of smart grid, but not smart grid in its reality in total. Demand response. NSP, previous to Xcel Energy, and Xcel Energy have been a leader in demand response programs for many decades, two, three decades, before smart grid. With smart grid, we believe we can take demand response to a whole new level. That's not yet proven yet, but we believe that it's possible. So demand response, again, is part of smart grid, but not the total picture. So you might be asking yourself, what is smart grid? And at this point in time, let me just give you a couple-minute vision of what it is for Xcel Energy, and in a few slides I'll get into a whole lot more detail. It's knowing what the energy is doing before it's an electron to after it's an electron. It's knowing what the energy is doing as a fuel source to an end use. So think of a lump of coal to cool air, or think of wind to light. Today, we don't know what that energy flow is doing along the entire value chain of creating energy, turning a fuel source into an end use. With smart grid, we do, and that has all sorts of ramifications for the utility, for society, and for consumers, potentially anyways. So, like I said, we started this journey about 3.5 years ago, and one of the first things we did was we started to create small, very localized, quick-hit smart grid projects to test out some theories and some technologies. And at this point in time, I think it's very fair to say that there are many more questions than answers about smart grid. When we got done with some of those quick-hit projects, we then thought to ourselves, well, what next? So we decided to bring our vision of smart grid, again, coal to cool air, wind to light, knowing what that electron is doing along the entire value chain, to life in some city of scale and prove out all of the benefit that we anticipated being there. So we wanted to create an event a catalytic event. We wanted to test much more than just meters or demand response. We wanted to take advantage of what we believed and later proved were a great opportunity with partnerships. In reality, a utility, there isn't a lot of motivation for a utility or technology firms to spend dollars in R&D, but with our effort in Smart Grid, there were many willing partners ready to come to the table and co-invest in a project like we had proposed. We didn't want to choose a technology winner in advance. Like I said, there are many more questions than answers at this point in time, so we want to test out multiple technologies, multiple rate structures, multiple in-home devices, and evaluate the consumer behavior against some of those. And we wanted to test out multiple benefit hypotheses. We've identified on the order, 50 to 75 different specific, very quantifiable hypotheses, which we hope to prove or disprove as part of our Smart Grid City effort. So again, Smart Grid City was bringing our vision of Smart Grid, coal to cool air, wind to light, to reality in some city of scale and test out all of the hypotheses, either right or wrong, to help make a much more informed and better decision of how to install Smart Grid or what portions of Smart Grid to install across the enterprise. So let me get into some details of what this vision, this rather ambiguous vision of coal to cool air, wind to light means. This is a diagram of the value chain of creating electricity. On your left is the generating, the supply part of it, the generating plants or the windmills, and of course on your right is the consumer. So let me go through each of these individual projects, and I'd ask that you consider them a piece of Smart Grid, and then I'd also ask you to imagine them connected all together with a robust real-time information flow and what that might mean to not only consumers but society and the utility. So on the far right, a web portal project. Excuse me. This is providing a set of tools for residential customers that allow you to program your own energy use. Today, when I ask a question of consumers, how much money do you spend a month in electricity, as an example, most people roughly know. But after that, they don't know much. They don't know, for example, what percentage of that is spent on refrigeration versus lighting versus electronics versus whatever. This would allow them to not only know that, but also automatically control their energy use against real-time price signals and against environmental signals. There's been a number of pilots done in North America and Western Europe that have demonstrated, albeit on a much smaller scale than our Smart Grid City, that you can reduce peak energy by 25-30% and energy use by 10-12% if utilizing the most current technology. So again, this allows a consumer to understand their energy use better and automatically program their own appliances against not only real-time price signals, but also against an environmental signals, which has not been ever tested before. And by that, I simply mean, in a simple example, don't let me watch my plasma TV unless the wind is blowing and providing me with the energy, as an example. Plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. Some might wonder why electric vehicles are part of Smart Grid, but to us it makes a lot of sense. First of all, let me explain what plug-in hybrid electric vehicles are. It's taking today's Toyota Prius or hybrid Toyota Prius or hybrid Ford Escape or any other number of cars, removing the battery pack and putting a much more robust battery system in it, plus a cord, allowing you to plug into any outlet that's available to you. Plus a device that tells us what part of the system you're, what part of our system, the electric system you're plugged into, plus some devices that allow you to not only take energy from the grid, but push energy to the grid. And if you can imagine the Twin Cities with 50,000 or 100,000 PHEVs, plug-in hybrid electric vehicles out there, that's 50 to 100,000 10 kilowatt hour energy, distributed energy resources that can be used for all kinds of potential benefit, storage of renewable energies, solving a reliability issue, solving an overload condition on the system. And the mind quickly goes to, if you think about it long enough, you might get a little overwhelmed at the various services and products that might be available if you own a PHEV and what kind of agreements you might enter into with the utility. PHEVs, plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. We started about 2 years ago converting six Ford Escape hybrid electric vehicles to six Ford Escape plug-in hybrid electric vehicles and are testing some of these hypotheses right now. As part of our Smart Grid City effort in Boulder, Colorado, we are planning to add an additional 50 to 100 PHEVs to that experiment. And just a couple things about PHEVs. If you take a hybrid Ford Escape, you get something on the neighborhood of 35 to 40 miles per gallon. If you convert that to a PHEV, that jumps up to about 100 miles per gallon. And at XL Energy electricity prices and $2 a gallon of gasoline, the operating cost of that vehicle gets cut in half. So there's some other benefits to not just being part of Smart Grid. Smart OMS and Smart Distribution Assets are really a similar project just in two different jurisdictions, and I'll focus on the one in Minnesota. Back in the mid-90s, NSP installed a very early generation of smart meters. Typically, they were referred to as AMR, automatic meter reading. And I won't get into the details of the downside to the smart, the early generation versus today's generation. But needless to say, it's not fully two-way. Two-way communications doesn't exist with that generation. But there are ways to utilize it to help with the distribution operations and prove out some of the benefits of a smart grid world. For example, it surprises some people to know that when you have a relatively localized electric outage, electric utilities count on our customers to call us and tell us they're out of power. We don't know otherwise. Well, utilizing these early generation of smart meters, we'll be able to tell where the outages are, and we won't require a phone call. And there are other benefits that we hope to prove as a result of that. But as an example of a smart grid world, knowing where outages are, knowing the real-time circumstances of the distribution system will be important. Smart substations. Not too far from here, we have a Merriam Park substation where we, as part of those smart grid quick hit projects, put in 21st century technology, which basically makes it part of the grid that is fully capable of self-healing itself, and very similar to the meter example I just went through, rerouting power where trouble exists, knowing much more about problems on the grid, knowing much more about the life cycle of the various components in the substation, having much better information of when something is likely to fail, allowing potentially, again, there are many more questions than answers, allowing for many more opportunities to predict failures rather than wait for them to occur. And then in addition to that, we're also testing out some new technology around infrared, which, again, is part of our smart grid vision. Some of you may have read about or understand to some level of detail, we've had a lot of copper theft problems over the course of the last 18 months. Well, as part of this smart substation, we're implementing a 24/7 infrared scan, which allows us not only to take temperature of electric components because they get hot before they fail, but also identify people that are in the substation, automatically query our scheduling system or work management system, notifying us when people are in a substation that shouldn't be there, and taking the next necessary steps. Again, a specific example, there are, you know, tens or if not hundreds more I could provide you of what's going into our smart substation. Neural Networks is a project in Colorado where we are testing, it's really artificial intelligence. This is less of a concern today given the economic situations, but when we started this 2 years ago, we had a very real problem of many older workers that were eligible to retire. And this was all about capturing the working knowledge of power plant operators at a specific power plant in Colorado, testing the ability to use technology or artificial intelligence to basically help younger new employees come up to speed much quicker. Wind to batteries. This is a project in Laverne, Minnesota, which is testing a utility-scale battery system to store wind power. It's a 1.2 megawatt battery system connected to a windmill, more than one windmill, but a handful. And we're not just testing the economics of storing power in batteries, because that's not new, albeit the technology of battery we're using in this project is new. We're also testing what happens if there isn't one of these, but 10,000 of them. What happens to the three people down in downtown Minneapolis whose job it is to control and dispatch the power plants for the NSP jurisdiction of Xcel Energy? So a fundamental change here in a smart grid world potentially is that you go from managing, you know, on the order of 50 to 100 power plants, the Monticellos and Prairie Islands and Sherco's and Highbridge's of the world, to tens of thousands of power plants, or maybe even hundreds of thousands of distributed power plants, if you can include PHEVs. And what is the technology, what are the algorithms that are needed so you don't overwhelm the employees of Xcel Energy in trying to manage a grid like that? So that's part of our wind-to-battery effort. So let me take a step back. The vision of our smart grid effort in Boulder is knowing what the energy is doing before it's an electron to after it's an electron, wind to light, cold to cool air. Examples of that in very vertical pieces of the utility I just went through. So think of those as you think of a smart grid world, but then also think of connecting that information flow together. So what does it do to a consumer? I gave you this example earlier, but what does it do to a consumer to have the power to automatically program and control their energy use against price signals and environmental signals? What does it do to a phone agent at Xcel Energy to know when the power is out at a home before the consumer does? What does it do to the people who operate the distribution or transmission system to have much more information because of smart distribution assets and smart substations? How will that help us be more effective in terms of reliability and cost management and safety even? What does it do to the people who manage and control and dispatch power plants when the world goes from 50 to 100 power plants to tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands? All kinds of problems or opportunities, if you look at it that way, to wrap your mind around when it comes to a smart grid world. Just as an added data point around plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, what you're seeing up here is through the year 2007, the growth of hybrid vehicles. If this was to date, it would be near 1 million units in the United States. And just to paint a picture for you around the value, the dual value of electric vehicles, or in this case, PHEVs, if for every... if there were 350,000 PHEVs out there, that's power for 3.5 million homes for 1 hour. So the real thing that's changed here around why electric vehicles or PHEVs are important to a smart grid world is the dual value path. It's a car, and it moves people, and it moves things, but it's also has the potential to be a very valuable distributed energy resource. So let me get into a little bit, now that I've spent some time on the vision of Smart Grid, let me tell you a little bit about our Boulder project. As I said, when we did the quick hit projects, which I just described in a fairly high level, we then asked ourselves, what's next? Well, we wanted to bring them all together and make that integrated horizontal information flow a reality. To some level of scale. So we weren't looking at hundreds of customers. We were looking at tens of thousands of customers. So a couple of key components in picking a city, The first and foremost is we wanted it to be 50 to 100,000 in population. The second component is we wanted it to be operationally isolatable. So we didn't want to confuse the consumers in the city or the utility employees, so we wanted it to be somewhat of an island, if you will. So when we did a search on cities in the Xcel Energy service territory of, you know, on the 50,000 mark, and that we're a relative island in the context of the electric system, you know, the list was relatively short. And then we went through all kinds of other evaluations and ended up in Boulder. We went live publicly in February of 2008. We broke ground in 2008, and then you can read through all the other the milestones we've met. As I mentioned earlier, Boulder is a unique, in my opinion, a unique business model where the total investment for making Boulder the country's first smart grid city is in the $100 million range, of which Xcel Energy is spending $15 to $20 million. Our partners are bringing to the table the rest. And one of the attractive components of it to our partners is they really don't have a proving ground. So this represents a great opportunity to prove their technology and create a market where additional revenues and profit will come. So.
Okay. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lamb, on those of that money, is any of it government subsidies?
Madam Chair, Senator, not today, no.
Thank you. You can continue.
Okay, you're welcome.
Oh, Senator Dipple has a question.
I like that, not today. Will it be? Are you looking at the stimulus dollars, for example?
Madam Chair, Senator, we are. But I think we're still trying to figure out what that means for us. Thanks. So a lot more questions than answers at this point in time.
Thanks.
But clearly there's a lot of stimulus dollars out there that may or may not be relevant to this effort.
Madam Chair. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lamb, you mentioned your partners. I'm sorry, maybe you went through your partners before I got here. Who are your partners, or are they the ratepayers, or who else is part of
Mr. Lamb?
Madam Chair, Senator, I was just about to do that, so great question, great timing. Our partners, I'll go through our partners one by one. So as part of the effort, we are installing broadband over power line as the communications network, BPL. Some people refer to it as BPL. And our partner with respect to that is a company called Current Group. BPL has lots of advantages. In effect, the communication signal goes across our power lines. And when complete, it makes every outlet in a home or building internet enabled. It's very reliable, it's very robust, it has low latency. So those are all the good things. The bad things is it's expensive. So I'm not here to advocate that BPL is the answer. It was the answer for Boulder because we had a willing partner come to the table. A second partner is a company called Ventyx, V-E-N-T-Y-X. They are helping with all kinds of back office IT work. They supply Xcel Energy with many of our enterprise-wide systems, scheduling, work management systems, et cetera, so all of which have to be integrated into Boulder. So they're providing a lot of help in regards to that. A third partner is Accenture, which is also helping on the IT side. They're right beside Ventyx, if you will, with other systems that they support for Xcel Energy. In addition, they've given Smart Grid City a global reach because of their breadth of their breadth and exposure across the globe. A fourth company is called GridPoint. GridPoint is out of Washington, D.C., and they are supplying hundreds of in-home devices. So that web portal project I spoke about, they are supplying pieces of that. From an extreme of full control of a house plus a 10 kilowatt hour battery system to just the web portal as I described it earlier. So those are the, I feel like I'm missing a couple, but those are the key ones, Senator.
Thank you.
can continue now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I won't read through this list, but needless to say, there's been a lot of work done in making a smart grid city in Boulder come to life. In a general sense, we hope to have the build out complete in 2009, and then utilize 2010 as a learning year. Like I've said several times, there's many more questions than answers. We want to try to answer some of those questions to not only give Xcel Energy information about how smart grid should be rolled out, but also the industry in general. So towards the end of 2010, we hope to have conclusions around both the successes and the failures of our smart grid city effort. Because so much of our effort is focused on evaluating consumer behavior in this new smart grid world, we're offering many different choices, and some of them are up on, or all of them are up on the screen for our smart grid city effort. And think of it as I'll offer the two extremes. One is do nothing. I want nothing to change. I still want to pay my bill just as I've always paid it. I don't want to react to price signals or energy or environmental signals. Just basically treat me how you've always treated me. To the other extreme, where people want to sign up for the full automatic control and battery backup, and they want a PHEV and they want solar panels, they truly want to experience all that there is to offer in a smart grid world and all of the changes that come with it. And then a whole, several in between those two extremes. Again, the reason we're doing this is to answer the many questions that are out there, and specifically the many questions are out there around the consumer end of things. How will they react to a smart grid world? How will their behavior change? How willing will they be to enter into agreements that today don't exist? For example, if I own a PHEV, how willing is a driver or an owner of a PHEV to offer it up as a distributed energy resource, as one example? How willing will consumers be to let a utility control their appliances or their thermostat, albeit for some sort of compensation, for lack of a better word? What is the potential out there? That's what these bundles are designed to help us answer. So at the end of my presentation, there's a website that I'll...
Senator Rummel has a question.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you go back just a second when you were talking about the willingness of customers to allow their thermostats or appliances to be controlled? Explain that a little bit more. What would that be like?
Madam Chair, Senator, in a smart grid world, let me use this very specific example to paint a picture. In a smart grid world, you would have an appliance that, and you may today, depending on how old your appliances are, you might have a refrigerator or freezer that has a temperature on it, just like your thermostat. So you might enter into an agreement with your utility in a smart grid world to allow them to manipulate the temperature of your refrigerator or your freezer. Again, don't know how consumers will react to that, but it's a possibility. The technology exists, and in pilots, it's been demonstrated to significantly impact peak energy use as well as total energy use. And why, I guess I should have said at the beginning, a couple things have changed in my view that have made this a more probable rather than as compared to 5-6 years ago. I guess in a nutshell, it's climate change. If you look at public opinion polls of 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, the percentage of folks who believed in man-made climate change was relatively low. certainly less than 50%. Today, that number is very high. So anything to reduce carbon, I guess, has value. And as a second point, all electric systems out there in the country are built or designed for a fairly small number of hours per year because we have to build them to capacity. And in Minnesota, as an example, we reach capacity on a hot July afternoon when it's 95 or 100 degrees out. But if you add up those total number of hours, we build a system for 100 hours a year. Otherwise, it's underutilized. So anytime we can implement technology that helps us control that, there's potential savings.
Senator Rama.
So it's the middle of July, and I have this agreement with you, and you decide that you're going to turn down my air conditioner. Do you call me first? Do I find out ahead of time?
Mr. Lamb?
Madam Chair, Senator, those are all the questions we don't know. They have not been designed yet. As part of Boulder, I can tell you what our vision is, but they haven't been implemented yet, is you would sign up. There would be a set of tools, probably web-based, that would allow you to actually program what you would allow us to do. So given these price signals or given these environmental signals, I am okay with you changing the temperature in my house from 70 degrees to, pick one, 80 degrees. Mm-hmm. And for that, I get a X percent discount on my energy bill. Or, as the example I used earlier, I'm comfortable with you changing my freezer temperature from 0 to 20, or my refrigerator temperature from 35 to 45, and you have less cold whatever is in your refrigerator. Totally the choice of the consumer is our vision. Mm-hmm. We think the technology exists that allows consumers to make their own choice, and then automatically the action happens.
Would there be the opportunity for the consumer to have the information so that they made the choice to turn down their refrigerator, their freezer, their air conditioner?
Madam Chair, we don't think, absolutely, that's possible, but we don't believe consumers will want to be bothered with that amount of information. So our bias going in is that let you design your own energy use, but then don't bother me with the real-time interaction. Just let the system do the work. And you can always change it.
I kind of agree with you, but this is still America. And it might work in Europe better than it would work in America. I don't know. Is this system in existence anyplace else? A smart grid system?
Yeah, only in small, Madam Chair, only in small-scale pilots of a couple hundred folks. Boulder, to the best of my knowledge, our Smart Grid City effort is the first place that it's being built to significant scale.
Madam Chair.
Yeah. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Boulder is a perfect spot to implement something like this. But was there public buy-in or an awareness program about what the Smart Grid is? Did the citizens have a chance to have a discussion about it, or? What was the interaction with the Boulder citizens?
Mr. Lamb.
Madam Chair, Senator, once our decision was made, and there was some interaction that I wasn't necessarily privy to with the city leaders before we went public with it, it was widely received positively, extremely positively, actually. But we didn't engage the citizens before the decision was made. Since that time, though, we've held numerous focus groups throughout the city. We have many different stakeholder groups in the city that are actually helping us design the programs we want to test. And as a side point, once we went public with Boulder, it shouldn't have been, but it was a little surprising to me of how many cities contacted us that weren't Boulder that expressed, for lack of a better term, anger, frustration at not being chosen.
Really?
Senator Dipple. Sure.
Thanks, and apologize for preempting things we're going to get to. But is the Boulder pilot or any other pilots that are in operation, are they taking a look at entering into agreements with consumers to kind of tier their use of power, you know, agree to a certain, paying a certain price. If their daily or their monthly use of power overall is this much, and then you know, if they bump up and start using more, you know, they pay more for the power in an increment over the certain amount that they've agreed to.
Mr. Lamb.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think it's a fair statement to say those are still being designed, but in a general sense, yes. Yeah, I don't think all the details are known yet around the new pricing schemes, but you know, in a general sense, you hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, I'm sure. I think like in California, people can enter into agreements with their water service to use only a certain amount of water on a monthly basis, and then if they use more water than they agreed to use, then they'll pay more for you know that amount of water over the amount that they.
Okay, we can continue.
So as I mentioned earlier, we identified, depending on how you count, 50 to 75 specific, very quantifiable hypotheses that we want to either prove or disprove as part of our Smart Grid City effort. Those are all available on our website, which I'll offer up on the last page of the presentation. But if you just Google Smart Grid City, you'll get to it. Let me just spend a little bit of time on what some of those are. Let me start with the immediate column. If you go back, Smart Grid's not a new term. It's been around for probably 15 to 20 years, maybe longer. But if you go back 10 years or so, it was very much focused on that immediate column. It was focused on the grid, as people commonly referred to it, the poles and wires business of an electric utility, the transmission and distribution system, and the operational efficiencies that might be gained by the better information, the reliability improvements, knowing where outages are, knowing where failures might occur that you don't know today, much improved data, et cetera. Very specific, quantifiable, measurable improvements we're testing as a part of Smart Grid City around those items. Very traditional smart grid things. Now, if you fast forward, Smart Grid has become much more than an operations play. It's truly become an environmental play, which gets into some of the probable column. And again, there are many more questions and answers out there, but we think smart grid technology will allow us to take demand response to a whole new level. Not just efficient lighting or not just devices that cycle your air conditioner on at 15-minute intervals, but a whole new set of technologies that allow very, very precise changes to the way people use electricity. And to be quite honest, we think there won't be a lot of consumer sacrifice in those changes. You'll be able to program it around your own personal preferences. So you get into energy conservation, pricing options, remote connect and disconnect. That's more of an operations play, but all kinds of environmental plays that we want to test or prove. Possible. Reduce line loss. Today, any electric utility puts in a certain amount of megawatts on the generation side, and when you add up all the load on the consumer side, all else being equal, just because of the heat dissipation, the current flowing across the line, you're going to lose somewhere between 3% and 6% of the power you put into the system. That's true for every electric utility. By using devices like capacitor banks and voltage regulators and smart switches, you potentially can reduce that 3 to 6% amount of loss by a significant percentage. We think it's in the 15 to 30% range. That's an immediate impact to the bottom line. You need to produce less power for the same amount of load. As well as an immediate bottom-line impact to the emissions that you're creating as a result of generating power. I talked about PHEVs in some length. We think there's a lot of potential here in utilizing electric cars, and specifically PHEVs, as not only vehicles moving people and things, but also as distributed energy resources. Batteries, storage, CO2 reduction. I won't read through the list. The last one on the possible list, though, again, we don't think has been done before at any scale, and that's evaluating the benefit in the consumer behavior to environmental signals. What's listed up here is green price signals. Allowing consumers to understand what their carbon footprint is and actually manage their energy use against their personal preference around their own carbon footprint. Think of a low-carb diet, if you will, a different kind of low-carb diet. Again, the details behind all of these are available on our website. So the timeline for implementing the pricing programs for Smart Grid City and Boulder are up on the screen now. And this gets to some of the earlier questions. But starting in the last half of 2009, we want to work with the regulatory agencies in Colorado to file applications for pricing programs. So as I said earlier, they're still being designed as of today, utilizing those focus groups and other stakeholder groups in Boulder. We want to make them effective in the first couple of quarters of 2010. And then along with all the rest of the technology that we're trying to test and the hypotheses we're trying to test as a result of Boulder, evaluate how those pricing programs worked. We're trying to go into this without answers. We're trying to go into this with a list of questions and design a project that allows us to give answers to most of those questions. While to me this is a very exciting project and truly has the potential to be transformational of an industry that lags behind in terms of utilizing technology, it's not without challenges and issues. Several are listed up here, but I will start with one of our biggest surprises, and it shouldn't have been, was in implementing some of the infrastructure in Boulder, we realized the city of Boulder is named Boulder for a reason. Trying to dig into Boulder, the material Boulder, is a lot more difficult than sand or other types of soil. But the top issue is having a sample size that we can utilize to extrapolate the results. The primary reason we're doing Smart Grid City is to develop answers to questions. Well, we want to make sure we have valid results when we get done. And that's a of primary concern. And I will add that there is some caution around utilizing the results in a city like Boulder to the rest of America. We recognize not every city is like Boulder, so we have to also take that into consideration. There are an issue challenge around the whole issue of what happens if we're widely successful at reducing load, if we're not only peak load but energy use, and how does that translate into fixed cost loss? Gets into things like decoupling and very controversial subjects around really transforming the electric energy industry. We spent a lot of time trying to communicate with customers in various forums. I'm on the third bullet now. And one reason why I and others present on this subject so often, trying to communicate what smart grid is to us. It's not an easy concept to wrap your mind around. So the more we can get out in front of that and communicate what it is, what the potential benefits are, what the potential impacts are to society and consumers, the better. Making sure the data and billing analysis is accurate. Because we've installed a robust communication system and two-way smart meters in Boulder, we have a great deal of data that we didn't have before. So making sure that's treated with accuracy and performing analysis on it is a key. There's a huge data challenge around a smart grid world, and I'll just give you one data point that might help with this. Xcel Energy serves roughly 3.3 million electric customers. Let's just assume 3 million of those are residential customers. So we take 3 million meter reads a month, and we have to manage 3 million meter reads a month and do all the things we do with those. In a smart grid world, we might take a meter read for residential customers every 5 minutes or every 10 minutes. Suddenly that 3 million gets exponentially larger. So what do you do with all that data? How do you build the IT systems to handle it? What algorithms are needed so you can make sense of that data and use it in an optimum fashion is a key issue challenge. And then the last one up here is since it's not been done before, or at least not been done on any scale, is designing a measure that makes sense to consumers around an environmental signal, a carbon intensity measure. How do you provide a signal to a consumer that makes any sense around their own personal carbon footprint and allow them the opportunity to understand it enough so that they can change their energy use accordingly? So that's my presentation for this afternoon. I thank you very much for the time. I'll leave you with a couple of thoughts. Think of a today's world versus a smart grid world, and managing 50 to 100 power plants in today's world to a smart grid world where you have to manage or at least consider, you know, tens of thousands or perhaps hundreds of thousands of power plants, PHEVs, wind to batteries, et cetera. Each individual appliance can be considered a power plant, if you will, because you can reduce the load. And think of what traditionally is what is called a load-following industry. Electric utilities project what the load is going to be and try to provide supply to match the load. We follow the load. Whatever the load is doing, we follow it. To an industry that shapes the load. So we're not beholden on just simply following the load, but we actually have a say in how to shape the load and the economic and environmental benefits of that transformation. So again, thank you, and it's time for Thomas Edison to meet Bill Gates, in our view. So that's it's a little bit about Smart Grid City and Boulder and our vision.
Senator Carlson?
I'm really curious about a lot of things, and one of the things I'm thinking about is just establishing a baseline in this particular area. Now, does this area have, for instance, off-peak and interruptible and cycled and off-peak rates, things like that?
Mr. Lamb?
Madam Chair, Senator, if by this area do you mean Boulder?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
For the commercial and for the large commercial and industrial customers, some of that exists, but the residential market is largely untapped.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lamb, are you putting together this as a study or as an experiment? Are you just like you were saying that a lot of people have requested certain equipment and vehicles? I mean, are they getting them, and then you're looking at that population? And I guess also, how large is your focus group?
Mr. Lamb.
Madam Chair, Senator, I perhaps confused the matter. We enlisted focus groups to help us design the product bundles and help us design our communication strategy. But they're not the sample size. The sample size is truly the community of Boulder. So it's 50,000 strong. I'm not exactly sure the exact population. So everyone in Boulder is eligible to participate in Smart Grid City. Everyone will be Smart Grid enabled. So when I said people, when I commented on people have requested equipment, I was simply responding to a question about the reception we got from the city of Boulder. It was very positive. Everyone wants to be part of it. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question or not.
Madam Chair and Mr. Lamb, I think you are, but I guess what what I'm concerned about is how we're going to learn about this whole exercise without knowing, you know, for instance, Madam Chair, I think what we can assume is that people really don't know very much about their power that they use. I don't think anybody here could tell me what, how many kilowatt hours they use per day. Very few people do, but a lot of my friends do because they pay attention to that sort of thing. And so what we need to do is we need to get people up to a certain level of education, of, you know, so that you know when you're starting to make a difference that can be extrapolated to a larger population. And I guess what I'm thinking of is that do you have, for instance, now I guess you've answered to the question on the focus group, but I would like to see something where you say that this is a typical region, this is a typical city, this is a typical original group, this is what they use, and then they get educated on how to use power. And really, for the most part, many of us could cut our power use very much lower than what we're presently at just by knowing how power is generated, when it comes, when to wash your dishes, and all of that sort of thing, how to use a water heater. It seems to me that it would be very valuable to know what that baseline is after people know how to use power, and then start to go to the levels of things that you control over the smart grid. And I guess what I'd really like to hear is that something like that might be going on.
Mr. Lamb.
Madam Chair, Senator, absolutely something like that is going on. I mentioned a couple of times we have 50 to 75 very specific quantifiable hypotheses. For each one of those, we've created a baseline. So we know what it is today. In Smart Grid City, we'll know what the impact is. So let me give you a couple of examples just to help make the point. We know what the reliability is of Boulder in terms of many different metrics. Once Smart Grid is in place and over the course of a year, we'll evaluate the impact to the electric reliability of that system. To your point, we absolutely know the baseline of what a residential customer utilizes, each and every one of them, actually. So we'll be able to evaluate by product grouping, a couple of pages ago. Sorry. By all of these, we'll be able to evaluate the impact of each one of those once Smart Grid is in place. And to each of those 50 to 75 hypotheses, the only way we're going to either prove or disprove them is to create a baseline. So we've done that for each and every one of them.
Okay. And Madam Chair, Mr. Lamb,
Senator Carlson.
When you mentioned the, I guess I was misunderstanding at the beginning in your notes, it said the 13,000 to 25,000 two-way meters have been installed, and then you're talking about two-way meters. And I didn't realize that's data two-way. That's not power two-way. You're not talking about feeding any power back into the grid.
Mr. Lamb.
Madam Chair, Senator, both. It's absolutely data two-ways, but it's also what's commonly referred to as net metering. So if you have a PHEV, plug-in hybrid electric vehicle, or if you have a solar panel on your roof, or if you have a battery system in your basement, it will also track the amount of energy you push back to the grid.
And then so, Madam Chair and
Senator
Mr. Lamb,
Carlson.
So you're supplying a system also that inverts the power then, goes from DC to AC?
Correct. Sorry.
It's okay. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, correct. As an example, the best example is the plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. So what we are doing is converting today's hybrid electric vehicle to a plug-in vehicle. So we put a more robust battery pack on it. We put a cord on it. We put what's called an inverter on it, which allows it to not only take power from the grid but push power to the grid. A GPS device so we know where the car is. A communication signal so we can talk with it. A system that allows us to know what part of our system it's plugged into so we can take advantage of it to offload distribution overloads or whatever. So there's a lot of technology on the PHEVs.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Lamb, then this system exists, and what's the price tab on that? Because that tends to be quite expensive to have the disconnects and the inverter and all of those systems put together.
Mr. Lamb.
Madam Chair, Senator, it's being built. So it doesn't exist today. There's some pieces of it that exist today. And the total cost of Boulder is the total investment is approximately $100 million. The specific cost of the converting a hybrid vehicle to a PHEV with all the technology I just spoke about is about $30,000, $25,000 to $30,000. So if you take if you go buy a Ford Escape hybrid for, I don't know what they are today, but $25,000, for example, you'd spend an additional $25,000 to make it into a PHEV. Now, I'd ask that you keep in mind that's because they're not production ready today. We're doing it all in the garage, so to speak. All the major car manufacturers have gone public with the desire to offer production version PHEVs within the next 3 to 5 years. So we fully expect, just like hybrid vehicles, when they first came out, they were very expensive, and now they're very comparable to non-hybrid cars. We fully expect that same sort of research transition to occur.
Okay.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. I'd encourage you to look at fully electric vehicles, too. They're right around the corner, too. Senator Rosen is chuckling. I'm excited. I'm really interested in this idea of pulling partners in together. I'm curious to know more about how that worked. And I'm also curious to know a little bit more about kind of the demeanor of either the Colorado Legislature or the Colorado Public Utility Commission in helping you recapture some of the costs that you're being put to. Because, you know, the dilemma is always, and we've had this discussion with my friends sitting over here, is, you know, we want our utilities to kind of do their thing as we conceived, you know, 100 plus years ago when we established the idea of monopoly utilities, that, you know, they should just kind of bring us power at a fairly cost-effective rate. But we're entering a new era now in which we're looking at really exciting innovations. And so where do we kind of draw that line? Innovations as a larger benefit to the ratepayers and the you know, kind of the public responsibility that utilities have, and justifying that in recapturing the cost that you're put to, versus, you know, adding a bunch of expense that maybe not what we want utilities to do. And I think we might have hit on something here with finding other kinds of business partners to help with these innovations and these experiments and the like. So my first question is the PUC in Colorado helping you recapture some of the expense that Xcel is going to?
Mr. Lamb.
Madam Chair, Senator, my esteemed colleague, Mr. Roy Palmer, is much closer to that part of the business, so he's joined me, and I'd offer him up as to answer that question.
Mr. Palmer.
Madam Chairman, Senators, my name is Roy Palmer. I'm the Vice President of Federal and State Affairs for Xcel Energy, but also for the last year and a half, I've been a project executive on the Smart Grid City project. My slice of that project was to work with the regulators and legislators, if need be, to come to exactly the solution that you articulately laid out, which is, in a traditional regulated utility model, what is the incentive, what is the cost recovery for us to engage in an R&D project like this? I think it's important to understand kind of the uniqueness of this project. We went forward with all of these other partners committing their capital and their dollars to this project, coupled with ours, and never did a PUC filing. We went in and talked to our commission, obviously, and said, you know, we're thinking of doing this project. We are comfortable enough making the investment and coming back to you in an after-the-fact review of how we spent our money, which is the way commissions reimburse us, essentially. We figured for our investment of $15 or $20 million to leverage another $80 million of private R&D that no matter how the project turned out, we would be able to successfully convince our legislature and or our regulators that this was a great project. The challenge comes in, if we had spent $100 million to build a big project like this, could you demonstrate that the costs produce enough benefit? You know, was it a good investment for the ratepayers? That's what we're trying to figure out. We want to be able to answer those questions before we come to, you know, Colorado on a larger basis or a big project in Minnesota. we'd like to be able to know what the value of having 5-minute interval reads is. Does it make sense to put in smart meters in every home? Does it make sense to put in a programmable thermostat in every home? You know, where's the sweet spot, benefit versus value? And, you know, to date, we haven't answered that question, but hopefully we'll have that information to be able to share with you and Colorado. And an interesting thing happened in the middle of it, which is the federal government decided that they wanted to spend a lot of money, and we're uncertain where that's going too.
Yeah, about I think Senator Carlson just showed me about $11 billion in the stimulus bill for smart grid.
For smart grid. Mm-hmm. And is that all going to Colorado?
Chairman, Mr. Roy Palmer again. Several things. The federal stimulus monies, about $4.6 million, which are directly to smart grid, the $4.6 billion all requires a one-to-one match. So for utilities like ours, if we were to propose a project, we would need to identify, you know, for every federal dollar, a matching dollar. DOE is working on promulgating rules, which I think will be out next week, which are going to talk about how those matches would work and what would qualify and what kinds of investments.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. And Senator Anderson just planted a question on me. I'm curious to know if any of this falls under your conservation improvement programs in Colorado. Any part of it can be construed to be part of your conservation efforts there under your SIP program there? That's one question, and then I'll ask Senator Anderson's question. If you apply for matching dollars for the stimulus program in Colorado, can you apply for any in Minnesota, or do you just get one bite at that apple in one state?
Mr. Palmer?
Madam Chairman, Senator Dibble, I'll take the second part of that question first. The answer is we're looking at it. We'd like to have discussions probably with our regulators, with our legislatures, with our other stakeholders, once we see what the federal guidelines are in terms of applying for projects. The Boulder project is basically built. That could backfill a lot of investment there. A big piece of that would probably involve whether we could get credit for matching what we've already spent there as the matching component. I think there is some reluctance in the company to spend hundreds of millions of dollars that would have to be matched on a smart grid project before we had a great definition of what we were trying to accomplish and what pieces of smart grid make sense. You know, you don't want to spend a lot of money if you don't have a lot of benefit.
And is any of this,
Senator Dibble.
Is it any of this coming in under your conservation efforts in
I'm sorry,
Colorado?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Palmer.
We anticipate that it will come in under our conservation programs. You know, just like in Minnesota, we do have energy efficiency goals. We do have programs. We need to make that linkage with what we're already trying to achieve, because keep in mind that the incentive here, as Mr. Lamb said, if we're wildly successful, we'll induce people to use less of what we sell. We'll make less money. So it needs to be baked together as part of a win-win proposition for the utility and the consumers and the state.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To either of the testifiers, I wanted to talk about the pricing programs. Were either of you into the development of those pricing programs?
Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Palmer.
I have been in the development of those programs and am in the development of those programs. What you see or saw on that slide in terms of our critical peak pricing and variable peak pricing, those are the kind of midstream product of conversations with our regulators and stakeholders in Colorado to see what kinds of pricing programs might yield the best result. We want to take those pricing programs and apply them along with different technology bundles so that, you know, someone would be on critical peak pricing. They would have access to our internet web portal. They would have a programmable thermostat in their home. What is the value of that set up in that pricing program next to someone who just has access to the web portal and no automated equipment in their home? Can you get 80% of the benefit without having to put the home products in? You know, that, and we want to have, you know, same way across all four or five or six different pricing pilots that we hope to put in eventually. You know, what are the value when you put that up against homeowners versus people that rent their homes? You know, what's the value against a 4,000 square foot home versus a small apartment? You know, what kinds of pricing programs will elicit consumer behavior that create a lot of value for the utility?
Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Mr. Palmer, then on the, we'll say the real-time pricing, for instance, you'll need to have some special technology, I assume, to implement that system. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, that technology exists, though, and is being rolled out.
Okay.
It's not, it doesn't need to be developed. It just needs to be implemented.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Other questions? It seems like, I mean, it's very exciting, very exciting. It's hard to imagine how this will all tie together and how long it would take for it to be in operation extensively. And maybe it'll go faster than we thought. The question is, how fast do people get up to using the hybrid electric vehicles, and how much are you able to use the energy from the battery packs when they're not in use, and but how you get them back on the grid. And but it just seems like it's a very exciting concept and very complex. Other questions? Senator Dibble?
Thanks. I just wanted to make a concluding comment. This is, I think, extremely interesting, and hope that maybe in a year we can get an update on how things are going and what kind of learnings we're finding and that sort of thing.
And let me ask you, do you expect in a year's time that you'd have significant results by that time? You expect to be built out by the end of this year, is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes. A year to 12 to 18 months, I would say. We certainly will know more at the end of 2010 because so much of our business is very cyclical depending on the weather. So once we have a full year under our belt, we'll know a lot more. So I would say 18 months is a better time frame.
Okay. Other questions? Well, thank you very much. It was a very informative presentation, and we appreciate your taking the time to bring it here. I want to let you know that we will be having meetings for the next two Tuesdays. Next week we'll have public utility commissioners being interviewed. They're up for reappointment and or appointment. And then the following week we will have a presentation on cap and trade. We have some